So our next presenter is, and forgive me for possibly,
Bjerke,
Elizabeth Bjerke. She is, actually holds two faculty appointments at the University of Pittsburgh. She teaches public health law at Pitt Public Health and in the School of Law. She's also the director of the JD MPH program and the associate director of law, of law and policy at Pitt Center for Public Health Practice. Also previously, she's been a litigator for private practice in New Orleans and Dallas, and also was the counsel for USDA in DC. Welcome.
I'm also somewhat technologically challenged, so there we go. I have no financial relationships to disclose. We are fortunate in Pennsylvania to have two vast natural resources. One is groundwater, and the second is natural gas. Approximately 3 million Pennsylvanians derive their drinking water from non-municipal water supplies. And in Pennsylvania and about half of the other states, there's no regulation of non-municipal drinking sources at the state level. There are three counties in Pennsylvania that do have local ordinances, but none of them have any shale gas development. Contamination of groundwater can occur either naturally or through local land use practices. And according to the CDC, contaminated water can cause gastrointestinal illnesses, reproductive issues, and neurological disorders. So we assembled a legal team at Pitt Public Health and created an advisory committee to look into whether or not our regulations and statutes in Pennsylvania are adequate to protect groundwater during unconventional shale gas development. Our advisory committee consists of doctors, geologists, hydrologists, public health officials, state government representative, environmentalists, as well as industry representatives. And we looked at one single question, which I referenced to. Unfortunately, this is not a hypothetical issue. In October of this year, the Clean Water Action Group filed a federal lawsuit against Waste Treatment Corporation, alleging that the discharge of drilling wastewater into the Allegheny River had high levels of salts, heavy metals, and radioactive compounds. And this is problematic because the Allegheny River is a drinking water source for about 400,000 Pennsylvanians, including me. These are only allegations, but hundreds of violations have been reported by the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection relative to groundwater. Where is Marcellus Shale? Marcellus Shale is named after a rock formation that was found in Marcellus, New York. And as you can see on this map, it primarily exists in five states: West Virginia, Maryland, Ohio, New York, and Pennsylvania. And in Pennsylvania, shale gas covers about 33,114 square miles, or about 74% of our total land mass. This slide shows just those well permits that have been issued this year. In total, as of November 2 of this year, a total of 13,387 well permits for unconventional shale gas development have been issued in Pennsylvania. This map shows the various shale plays throughout the United States and Canada. This shows shale play worldwide. The world is looking to Pennsylvania and other Marcellus shale gas states to develop their regulations globally. Under Marcellus Shale is Utica Shale. And if you can see on that map, the yellow outline is where Marcellus Shale is, and you can see it's even Utica Shale is even more vast in our states. In Ohio, they're already drilling Utica Shale because it's more shallow than it is in Pennsylvania and some other states. We strongly believe that they will develop the technology to develop drilling into Utica shale because it's a wet gas. And wet gas is more economically beneficial to industry because of the byproducts it produces. So what's the big deal? There have been drilling conventional wells in Pennsylvania since 1859, which is when the very first well was drilled in the United States in Titusville, PA. What's unique about Marcellus Shale is that until very recently, it was very difficult to extract because of the rock's high porosity yet low permeability. But now new technologies have been developed to untap this resource. Hydraulic fracturing is commonly referred to as fracking. And what it is this. A drilling string is used to bore a well. Successive steel casings are put down into the well. And these wells are very, very deep, as you can see. They're about 9,000 feet under the ground. Cement is then poured in between the casing and the shale to protect the gas from going into the well and from the hydraulic fracturing fluids going into the gas. Explosive charges are sent down into the well to perforate the deepest casing, and the cement sheath encasing it. Approximately 3,800,000 gallons of water and fracking fluid are used per well. We're fortunate in Pennsylvania that that's not a real issue. We have lots and lots of natural water in Pennsylvania, unlike some states such as Texas, where that is the water quantity is more of an issue than the water quality. Of that 3,800,000 gallons of fluid, about 90% of that is water, plain water. About 9.5% of that is proppant. And proppant can either be natural or synthetic. And it's put down into the well to keep the fissures that hold the natural gas open. The other 0.5% is chemicals. The chemicals are used to inhibit bacterial growth, prevent corrosion of the well casing, and to improve the placing of the proppant. The actual fracturing experience takes between 2 and 5 days. The numbers vary significantly, but according to the Marcellus Shale Center, approximately 10 to 20% of the fluid that goes down in the well comes back up. This water is very, very dirty. It contains not only the chemicals and proppant that went down into the well, but also something called formation water, which is the naturally existing water in the shale. And this water is dirty because it contains radioactive materials, heavy metals, and total dissolved solvents. It also contains production water, which is the water that comes up after the gas is emitted. This slide shows some of the very, very important federal laws that protect public health and the environment. Each of these laws, and there's one law that got cut off, it's CERCLA, which stands for the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, protect our environment and public health at a natural level, a national level. Each one of these laws, as well as CERCLA, exempts the oil and gas industry from federal regulation. There is one exception for the Safe Drinking Water Act. If a company uses diesel fuel in its fracking, it will be governed by this act. But I'm unaware of any industry practice that follows that with diesel at this point in time. So this is not to say it's an unregulated industry. It means that the regulations then fall to the states. And in Pennsylvania, a new law was enacted on February 14, 2012 to strengthen the environmental standards, and that's referred to as Act 13. There have been a lot of new regulations proposed by the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection to go in conjunction with Act 13, and I'll be addressing those in a minute. So what we did, we wanted to look at Pennsylvania statutes and regulations as objectively as we could. So we, in a previous grant that I worked on, which deals with emergency preparedness, response, and recovery, we developed a coding methodology whereby portions of legal text were substituted with numeric representations. Why is this a good idea? Well, it's a good idea if a bunch of lawyers are looking at the same law or various laws, and it would be a lot more objective to use a code book and put numbers in than have Elizabeth Farrell Bjerke summarize it one way and another attorney summarize it a different way. It also lends itself to replicability. If someone wanted to analyze the law, say, in Ohio, they could take our methodology, use the same numbers, and we could very easily compare laws across state borders. Laws in different states are written very, very differently. And by making it objective, you can compare the laws across state lines. One of the important findings that came up when we were using this methodology is how Pennsylvania defines waste. As I said, this water is very dirty, it's waste. How is it defined? Well, in Pennsylvania, hazardous wastes are defined as materials that pose a substantial present or potential hazard to human health or the environment when improperly treated, stored, transported, or disposed, or otherwise managed. Pennsylvania exempts the oil and gas industry from that definition. So in Pennsylvania, the waste produced by oil and gas companies is considered to be residual waste. And this is significant because if it is hazardous waste, a bunch of federal and state guidelines come into play. You might have heard the expression, handling waste from cradle to grave. It's very, very, very strictly regulated. Residual waste, not so much. So we developed three scenarios that, with our advisory committee, we thought were potential ways groundwater could be contaminated. First was well casing failure, spills on or near the well site, and from the storage of the wastewater. And we also took a look at these laws from a public health perspective. We analyzed them in terms of whether they were preventative, whether they spoke to remediation, or whether they spoke to liability. We also looked at over 103 pages of reports produced by the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, which were citation violations, and we looked to see if any of those violations pertain to these three areas. We wanted to see if our scenarios were just a hypothetical academic exercise or whether they had some basis in fact. So the first area we looked at was well casing failures. Now, well casings can fail from stresses from the chemicals that are put down, from bacteria that exist in the soil, from aeration, and also from human error. We've determined with our advisory committee that the regulations and statutes in Pennsylvania governing well casings are very, very strict when you compare them to other states and to industry best practice. Irrespective of that, we found over 63 well casing violations in that 1 year period. With respect to setback regulations, in Pennsylvania, wells cannot be drilled within 1,000 feet of a water well or 500 feet from a building, which is much more stringent than exists in Ohio. For casing requirements, we require the casings to be cemented from top to bottom. And about 11 different states mandate specific types of cement to use, including Pennsylvania. These well casing requirements, as I said, are all consistent with industry best practices, yet incidents have occurred. With respect to spills of hydraulic fracturing chemicals near the well site, when I said about 3,800,000 gallons of water and other things are put down, that means of that number, 38,000 gallons of chemicals are used per well. And what happens mostly is that the chemicals are transported to the well site in concentrated doses, and the companies mix the fracking fluid on site. In Pennsylvania, there's no laws that mandate how these chemicals are stored. There's also no mandate in Pennsylvania that a company needs to put a liner down when they mix the chemicals. Now, from my conversations with industry, they tell me that They all do it. All the major chemical companies put down a liner, which makes a lot of sense. If you cook and you're mixing things, you want to make sure that your counter is protected or your floor is protected or your person is protected. But we suggest that the laws need to change to mandate the use of these well liners to bring everybody up to the same standards that best industry practices mandate. We found about 65 incidents of involving contamination of water, involving chemical spills on or near the well site. This wastewater must be stored before it is treated. It's often difficult to treat because of the level of radiation and totally dissolved solids in the water. There are a bunch of options for the storage of well water, and I'm going to briefly talk about each of those. During the year that we looked at those violations, there were about 73 incidents of groundwater contamination from leakage of wastewater and about 43 additional violations of pollution without a reference to the genesis of the problem. This is a picture of a well site. On the left is a picture of an open air impoundment, and I'll get to that in a minute. One way that this wastewater can be stored are in metal tanks. These are called frac tanks. They're mobile steel containers, but because of the huge volume of wastewater, each well site might need up to 250 of these to store well water, and that is not a very economically feasible alternative for industry. These are expensive to rent, and most often they're used in conjunction with open air impoundments or to transport the water from the site to a treatment facility. Our friends in Ohio use underground injection wells. We cannot do that in Pennsylvania by and large because of our geography. Underground injection wells are categorized by the type of fluid that they contain. Fluid from the oil and gas industry is categorized as a Category 2 type of well. In Pennsylvania, we only have 8 Type 2 wells approved for wastewater disposal. In Pennsylvania, they're governed by the EPA regulations. In Ohio, the EPA approved a primacy program, so Ohio law governs their underground injection wells. For a while, companies were transporting wastewater from Pennsylvania to Ohio for disposal in these underground injection wells, but that became problematic because of the insufficient capacity of the wells and because it was cost prohibitive for Pennsylvania companies to do this. Recently, you all might have heard that there is a suggestion that there is a linkage between earthquakes and underground injection wells in Ohio. And a lot of my friends get confused on this. It's not the hydraulic fracturing that is thought to cause the earthquakes. It's the disposal of the wastewater in underground injection wells. This slide represents a method of drilling called closed-loop drilling, which lessens or eliminates the need to store the wastewater. What happens is on-site, a series of storage tanks separate the liquids and the solids using screen shakers, hydrocyclones, and centrifuges. The companies then take the water that has been treated and use it to frack another well. Now, this is a great idea, but as well permits get fewer and fewer, the need for recycled water will diminish, and they will still have to figure out a way to effectively dispose of it. This is a picture I actually took. This is an open air impoundment, and this is the way most wastewater is stored in Pennsylvania. There are two types. This is a centralized open air impoundment, meaning this is a company that allows a bunch of different companies to come and store their wastewater in one central location. Get back to this. This is an on-site open air impoundment. They look very similar, don't they? These are very, very, very large They're between a third and a half the size of a football field. They're very, very big areas. And what's significant is, in Pennsylvania, they're regulated totally differently. If you dispose your wastewater on site, the statutes and regulations mandate that you have to have one liner, period. Now, it would be very, very difficult to tell if you had a leak in that impoundment unless it was enormous. Plus, it's open. So when it rains, the water level and the fluid level goes back up. So even if it's diminished, it goes back up, and you might not realize that there is a leak in your single liner. If you look at the centralized, which again, to me, there's no discernible difference. They both store the same materials, but they're just stored in different locations. Centralized open air impoundments have to have two liners with a leak detection system in between. So if the primary liner starts to leak, the operators are notified that there's a leak, a sump pump goes into play, and the wastewater is safely diverted from groundwater. We recommend that both on-site storage wastewater storage facilities and centralized storage facilities be treated the same way. I've asked a bunch of industry people, why is there a difference? Explain to me why these things that, in my mind, are apples to apples are treated like apples to oranges, and I have not yet been told why they should be treated differently. There's also a problem in terms of sustainability with these both open-air impoundments that are centralized and on-site, because what do you do when you're done with that liner? It's not hazardous waste, but that water's been very, very dirty. For the temporary sites online, they can keep wastewater in there for up to 9 months or longer in Pennsylvania if the Department of Environmental Protection allows it. These have no limitations. So when you're done, what happens to the liner? In terms of future projects, we would like to use our coding methodology to compare and contrast the laws of all five Marcellus Shale states. We also would like to look at whether or not there's a correlation between health outcomes and well water regulation, because as I said, in Pennsylvania, in about half the states, it's not regulated at a state level. Another problem we have noticed is that they use silica sand to drill these wells. Sand, when it rubs against metal, creates silica. And as we know, silicosis in the shipbuilding industry and other industries have been a big problem for a long time. Finally, we would like to look at the mental health aspects of Marcellus Shale drilling and community health. A legal framework must be developed to balance economically valuable fuel production, irreplaceable environmental resources, and most importantly, to protect population health. When I'm asked about this by my friends at cocktail parties, what I think of the oil and gas industry, I make an analogy to the automobile industry. Both are very necessary, but both have a lot of dangers associated with them. When I was a child, way back in the day, we had no seatbelt laws. We could go all over the car on trips. Then we had seatbelts, and then we had lap belts, and now we have airbags. And with respect to unconventional shale gas development in Pennsylvania, we're kind of at the lap belt stage of regulation. We need to make sure and monitor the regulations to make sure that they're as tight as possible, and we need to look at them on an ongoing basis since the technology associated with drilling changes day to day to day. And that is my presentation, and thank you very much. I I have a broken ankle, so I took my shoes off to talk.
Thank you. Can we get another round of applause for our speakers?